Hi, you are listening to DNA Dialogues, where we dive into the intricate world of genetic counseling research. I'm Kate Wilson.
I'm Kalita Leopold.
I'm Naomi Wagner.
And we are your co-hosts. Join us as we peel back the layers of groundbreaking articles from the Journal of Genetic Counseling, bringing you exclusive discussions with the authors themselves.
Each episode sparks a vibrant exchange, exploring the latest discoveries, ethical dilemmas, and technological advances that are shaping the future of medical genetics.
From navigating complex testing decisions to building trust with diverse communities,
listen in as we unpack the science, challenge assumptions, and celebrate the human connection at the heart of genetic counseling research.
So grab your headphones, unravel the double helix, and prepare to be captivated by the array of voices in DNA Dialogues, a podcast where the blueprint of life meets intimate human conversation.
Hi, I am Kate Wilson. My pronouns are she, her. In this episode, we are exploring two recent articles focused on intersections of disability community and genetic counseling training and practice. I am talking with Lauren Douglas, she, her. She is a genetic counselor specializing in oncology at MHealth Fairview in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And Chelsea Wagner, she, her. She is a lead genetic counselor at Billion to One and current co-chair of the NSGC prenatal SIG. And I'm talking to them both about their recent Journal of Genetic Counseling paper titled Disability Education and Implications for Genetic Counselor Training. So Lauren and Chelsea, welcome. Glad to have you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
So I know in your paper, which we're hoping all the listeners will go check out, you had done a survey both of genetic counseling trainees as well as the disability community. So you had two survey populations. And one of the things that you talk about, I think right at the very beginning, is about sort of that tenuous relationship between the disability and genetic counseling communities. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that more, and also about how that historical prejudice against the disability community in medical fields may play a role.
There's certainly several factors that play a role here. And I think one of them being that the medical field really continues to struggle with some of these deep-rooted negative biases and misconceptions about people with disabilities. And I think many of us know that this really has stemmed from the eugenics movement, which aimed to eliminate some of those so-called undesirable traits. A lot of those eugenic practices caused widespread harm, especially to those populations that were being marginalized. And disability was often seen as bad, that should be erased. And it led to a lot of forced sterilization, social rejections, and institutionalizations. And so I think, you know, kind of going back to this relationship from these actions, we can see how the eugenics movement is a big source of distrust for the disability community and how it has shaped their views on genetics and the medical field in general. Certainly there's other factors as well. So I think impact of training, you know, training that medical providers receive may not address some of those diverse needs or perspectives of the disability community, and also an unconscious bias.
And you talk about this medical model of disability. So kind of how has that influenced the way that healthcare providers view people that have disabilities?
Great question. So the medical model in general views the problem within the individual that needs to be fixed or cured. So it focuses on an individual's impairment rather than their abilities and treatment options to achieve, quote, a normal function within society. And so a lot of critics of the medical model say that it really perpetuates a lot of these negative stereotypes about people with disabilities. And this certainly can influence how healthcare providers to hold certain biases. I think, you know, with a lot of the limitations from the medical model, a lot of people have actually started to adopt what's called the biopsychosocial model of disability. And so this model really talks about these interactions between physical, biological, psychosocial, and then the social factors that encompass disability. So certainly has a more holistic perspective.
Yeah, and I would just add to that, the medical model I often sort of summarize as like a subtraction model. It views disability as something is missing and really breaks down that person into individual parts and focuses on those parts not being what is expected. And I think moving towards these more holistic models, it's not that disability is a subtraction. It's an addition, and it's viewing all of those pieces together and how they operate and function in the world. And it's just different than others, and that's okay. So I do like that there are movements and new models being introduced to training.
I say, and that's a very helpful way to frame it. So I was like, can tell you've done some genetic counseling
in
your day.
So
appreciate the explanation. One question I do have, you know, and thinking about, you know, Chelsea, as you've probably been in the field a little bit longer than Lauren, but both of you have probably seen over time the advancements of genetic technologies. And so in genetics, I think one of the things that's challenging as a genetic counselor, we're talking about things like prenatal screening, diagnosing or trying to figure out maybe why somebody has a disability. So how does this rapid pace of genetic technologies diagnosing things earlier or screening even before people are born, how has that raised concerns in the disability community? And what are some things as genetic counselors we should be aware of in terms of the impact of genetic testing?
I know you've already thought a little bit about this, Lauren, so feel free and then I'll add on at the end.
So I think certainly this topic has sparked a lot of concern in the disability and how those technologies and the potential impact that they could have. And I certainly think it's understandable why the disability community might be hesitant about some of these new technologies when you look back at the history and really the impact of the eugenics movement. And as genetic counselors, you know, we really have this unique role of trying to balance between advocating for persons with disabilities while also promoting the reproductive autonomy of our patients. And this balancing act can certainly be challenging. And some of the disability advocates have been concerned that disability maybe isn't being presented in that balanced manner.
Yeah, and I will just echo what Lauren said. And as a prenatal counselor, I feel like theoretically you think about these issues, but every single day I'm talking to patients and families that are potentially making decisions about continuing a pregnancy or ending a pregnancy based off of what is shared with them in that appointment or by their medical team. And if we go back to the very beginning, remember our training has already biased us against this holistic disability perspective. And so we have to ask ourselves as practitioners, what are we presenting in the short amount of time? And is it a holistic and an addition perspective as opposed to a subtraction? And this is the one aspect that people are going to make their choices on. And it's hard. It's really hard. I've been doing this for a long time and I still struggle with this. So if you're a counselor and you also feel this push and pull and you don't know one day or another how you're going to feel, I also feel that. I do want to recognize that NSGC has been diving a little bit more into this intersection of disability and reproductive justice, which is especially poignant at this point in our nation's history. And they did host a really wonderful community conversations that really talked a lot about this eugenics movement, the historical context, and how these two perhaps opposing views intersect with each other. And so I encourage everybody to look at the NSGC's Community Conversations website, and there's some really interesting questions that are posed there.
One of the things I think that was really helpful about the study was, again, it surveyed people in the disability community, it surveyed people in the counseling community, and talks a lot about this kind of change in how we're teaching about disability or about, you know, working with people in the disability community. Currently, the Accreditation Council for Genetic Counseling, or the ACGC, they do talk about a curriculum, and part of that curriculum is disability awareness or training. So currently, what is the state or the requirements for genetic counseling training programs?
We had first started my thesis project. That was one of the first areas that we wanted to start with, was what was ACGC laying out for GC programs? And so when we take a look at the 2019 standards, ACGC does mention disability awareness kind of under the psychosocial instructional content. And then they also mention in the practice-based competencies, they do reference disability, but very vaguely, twice. So when we were looking at these documents, ACGC does not directly define disability, nor did they lay out or outline any of these necessary skills, information that GC students should be trained on. And so it really leaves each of these programs to have to interpret and come up with best practices for disability education.
One of the things too, I think that for folks who read the paper, there is some discussion about how much can be expected, right, of the Accreditation Council, because we do know that some of it is designed to be open-ended, right, so that programs can kind of adapt as they need. But I did want to mention that. But go ahead, Lauren.
Yeah, no, that's certainly important. And I think we found out later in our study that if ACGC did define these a little bit more strictly, that it could lead to certain barriers for programs. So certainly is important to mention, like you said. And one of the things that I think is really recognized in our GC community is to improve disability education. Before our study, there wasn't any previous research that focused on, you know, what elements should be included. And what Chelsea and I had noticed was really this lack of the disability community's voice in this conversation.
And I thought that was one of the beautiful things that Lauren brought to designing this study was involving the disability community in these discussions and then going beyond the, okay, we know we should do better or we want to do better, and really trying to figure out some next steps. So we know that we're not going to solve decades of this tenuous relationship between both communities, but Lauren really set out with her survey to define like first steps for programs. And it's like when you're going to write a paper, the blank page is really intimidating and it's hard to get started. But once you get some of that initial work down on paper and you're like, okay, I can do this, that's really where Lauren was focusing. Like, what are the first steps for programs and how do we incorporate the disability community in deciding what those steps are?
So I think that kind of leads to the next question, which is what did the disability community, how did they perceive their genetic counselor's knowledge about the medical aspects, the social aspects of disability? And I think there were some that had reported they never even talked about social aspects. So kind of what was some of that feedback from the disability community?
Just to kind of back up, our disability cohort, a subset of those individuals reported having genetic counseling provided by a genetic counselor where disability was discussed. So this is where that set of data was being pulled from. And from our disability cohort, they really did perceive that their genetic counselors had a really good knowledge or understanding of the medical aspects of disability. But what we found out is there is this gap in their genetic counselors' understanding and the discussion of social and lifestyle impacts of living with a disability. And like you had mentioned, Kate, you know, about 12% of that population of our disability cohort actually reported that their genetic counselor never discussed social aspects of disability at all. And I think what was interesting is we took a look at our GC cohort, and we actually found this data reflected in their responses as well. So majority felt comfortable discussing medical aspects, but they felt less equipped to discuss the social and lifestyle aspects. So to us, this really suggested that this is an area needing improvement in genetic counselor education and clinical practice as well.
Like Chelsea said, I think one of the things that is helpful about this paper too is you're trying to find out like, okay, so there's this area that's lacking and it's felt by both cohorts. So what were some of the suggestions from both the cohorts about how to improve this?
As part of our study, again, we really wanted to help kind of lay out this foundation for disability education. And so both the disability community and the genetic counselors agreed on these four kind of key aspects that should be included in this disability education. And so the first one was medical aspects of disability. Of course, as genetic counselors, we need to be able to provide that accurate information about these genetic conditions. And so, as again, we talked earlier, you know, this aspect is covered pretty sufficiently by the ACGC standards. So we did not ask for content suggestions for this particular aspect. So the other three aspects that we focused on were social and lifestyle aspects, the lived experience of persons with disabilities, which is a lot of firsthand experiences and exposures. And then finally, you know, looking at the history of the disability rights movement.
I'll add, when we kind of dove a little bit deeper into the social and lifestyle aspects, I think another great thing that we got feedback on from the disability community is kind of like, here's what I would have liked to know now that I've been in this body, I've been living this life, sort of that 2020 perspective of them going back and saying, actually, here's what I think would be helpful for medical professionals and genetic counselors to share about what it's like to be me. And within those social and lifestyle factors, they talked a lot about a lot of day-to-day resources. So what support resources, communities are available for people that have the same experience so that they can have a sense of community. What does work and employment look like? Are there accommodations that may need to be made? Those sorts of considerations. And then just like real human stuff. So like family planning, relationships, living, are they going to be able to live independently or what does that look like? I think in many ways, the social and lifestyle aspects seemed abstract at first, and we were really able to drill down and figure out what was important for our disability cohort and what they wished would have been shared with them as they were getting news of this diagnosis or learning about it for a family member.
And I think that that's very helpful because, again, it then takes something that seems abstract, right, and puts it into maybe some more tangible steps that can be taken. So you talk about kind of different suggestions and training approaches. One thing that I did think was intriguing was you mentioned, Lauren, the four areas, and one of them was sort of the historical disability rights movement. And it was interesting, both cohorts said that, you know, while important, out of the four, they both ranked it towards the bottom, like it was probably maybe the least important. I can speak to my training. I know we went over it quite a lot. So how do you think you can still incorporate the historical context, but maybe make room, like you said, for some of these other areas and these three areas that were ranked higher and of more importance?
Why out of those four, you know, key components that I listed, I think why the history of the disability rights movement was ranked last is, one, it could be seen as less directly relevant in a genetic counseling session or some of that patient care compared to some of those other aspects like medical knowledge, for example. Certainly there are time and curriculum constraints that programs are facing and certain prioritization of disability content. I think the historical advocacy issues may be perceived as less critical than the disability experiences and interactions themselves. And like you said, Kate, I also agree. I think this is still a very important topic because it does give perspective and societal attitudes and biases towards disability over time. And it's very important for some of those legal, ethical background on disability rights and policies, and certainly can help us as genetic counselors kind of thoughtfully navigate some of these new genetic technologies.
I'll also add that I do agree in genetic counseling programs, maybe we get actually a lot of disability rights or historical context because of the way that it is able to be shared or taught. So if you think about how you learned about disability rights, it was probably lectures or books that you read or essays or a Netflix documentary that came out, like shout out Crip Camp, that was amazing. But those types of learning modalities, I don't want to say they're easy because they're not, but those are the most common ways that genetic counseling programs teach students. And I think what we showed here is that we want to consider other teaching methodologies. So beyond the didactic classroom, how else can you learn? And I think those other areas of disability that we mentioned, like lived experience, social and lifestyle aspects, they don't lend themselves to a PowerPoint. They really lend themselves to something beyond words to paper. It's really about experiences. And those can be hard for programs to find and coordinate. So it's not easy. It's not an easy ask. Maybe that's where both cohorts were identifying, like, yeah, we can learn about this, but there are better ways we can learn about disability experience. And I think doesn't take away from the importance of the historical context, but I think it changes how we want to prioritize learning and teaching about disability.
I'll follow that up then to say, was there any suggestions from either of the cohorts about approaches to better understanding that lived experience or to getting exposure to the social lifestyle aspects?
Yeah, there certainly was. That was one of the areas that we had focused on. And it was interesting that both the disability and the genetic counseling community had different kind of perspectives on that. So I'll start with talking about the disability community. So they ranked, you know, direct exposure to everyday life as the most meaningful method for understanding that lived experience. And so essentially what this means is having rotations and visits with persons with disabilities to attend things like a family activity, an appointment, community events. And then they ranked lectures and discussions from persons with disabilities next. Kind of what we were talking about, you know, from the disability community, their lens is really focused more on these inclusivity in education, interactions with the community, and hearing some of these personal narratives. Where if we switch to the genetic counseling community, what they had reported was direct exposure, again, to everyday life as the most meaningful method. So certainly aligning with the disability community. They then ranked visits to group homes, specialized facilities, and disability community centers second. So when Chelsea and I were going through this data, I think that lens kind of focused more on gaining some of these practical exposures, identifying some community resources that genetic counselors can provide for their patients.
Yeah, and I think we saw that pretty consistently in the suggestions from both cohorts. It's because our motivations and where we're coming from are slightly different. The disability community is like, I just want you to understand what my life's like. And that is fantastic. And the genetic counseling community is like, I want to care for this patient in front of me. And I know that I have a limited amount of time with them. What's most impactful? How can I help them the most in this short time frame? And so those two motivations are slightly different. while genetic counselors, we want to give that holistic perspective, I think a lot of where the suggestions and sort of motivations from the genetic counseling cohort in the survey were like, how can we attend to the patient's immediate needs and what will help us do that? And so it was very practical sort of suggestions that they could apply not only in their counseling skills, but also in their clinical practice.
Well, and I think that that's very helpful too, because again, you talk about how the different cohorts, you know, for the most part are aligned to kind of the experiences, the training, where they want to be, what they want to see, and what's needed. But I think that's helpful, Chelsea, to understand too, that there's a part of the genetic counselor is like, well, what can I do in my session, right? My one-on-one time with the patient. Right. And I may or may not be chatting with this person. I may only get the one interaction. I may not have multiple right. interactions over mm-hmm. time. So that's helpful to understand. Mm-hmm. This was an extremely interesting article. I love the fact that you interviewed the two different cohorts and we're working together to bring something that is then again, tangible that programs can start thinking about today in terms of updating curriculum and experiences. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you wanted us to cover about the article?
I don't think so. I feel like we've hit the high points, and Lauren is absolutely an expert in this data and did an incredible job pulling it together into this very short article. So it's on record. You did such a fantastic job with this, and we were chatting before we started recording about how it can be really difficult to get your thesis published, and I've watched you work on this for 3+ years, and it was because you knew this was important for our community, and it was important for the people that took our survey and took their time to share their experiences. From the bottom of my heart, like, so proud of you for sticking with this project and for putting out such an incredible tool for the profession. So thank you.
Oh, well, Chelsea, that means so much. And you know that I could not have done this, obviously, without you by my side through everything. And I think, you know, we're both very proud that we have been able to put this out into the world and have this to be used by programs. And I think as a parting kind of last thought here, overall, this study really showed me that we really need to include the voice of the disability community in our training. And so if that's the one thing that you take away from this entire conversation today, I think that's one of the main things that I wanted to make sure that we highlighted in our paper, is that we really do need to lift their voices in our education sector.
I will say that there is a cohort and there's a community of genetic counselors that identify as having disabilities. And so while it is difficult for programs to maybe find somebody that's willing to speak about their experience or share their lives with somebody, there are genetic counselors that have this experience and are willing to step in and maybe be able to focus or highlight what's important in that disability rights movement for genetic counseling practice, because we live in both worlds. And I'm certainly one of those counselors. And I know there are many other counselors that are willing to share their experience and happy to be a part of the genetic counseling community and the disability community and bring these things together, as Lauren said.
Yeah, and I thank you both. Those are very important call outs. And I think it can lend itself to other areas too in genetic counseling training, is you got to talk to the community that you're talking about. They need participation. They need representation in the curriculum development. So that's very helpful. Thank you both. I appreciate you being here today.
Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to DNA Dialogues. Would you like to nominate a Journal of Genetic Counseling article for the show? If so, please check out the episode notes or our website for a nomination submission form. Multiple entries are welcome, and you can nominate articles written by yourself, your colleagues, or anyone you'd love to hear from. We can't wait to highlight more research from JOGC on DNA Dialogues. Hi, I am your co-host, Naomi Wagner, and my pronouns are she, her. I am speaking with Rachel Epstein, she, her, author of the recent Journal of Genetic Counseling article titled Experiences of Genetic Counseling Students with Disabilities and Chronic Illnesses, a Qualitative Study. Rachel is a genetic counselor at Endeavor Health in Evanston, Illinois. Welcome, Rachel. Thanks for being here today.
Hey,
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
To get started, can you share some background about how this study came to be?
I initially did this study as my capstone project when I was a genetic counseling student at Boston University's genetic counseling program. The inspiration actually came from an experience that I had in the fall of my first year of the program. We took a professional issues class during which we had a panel of genetic counselors with disabilities and chronic illnesses come and speak to us about their experiences navigating different aspects of the field. And it really left a pit in my stomach to hear that I was entering into a profession that claimed to advocate for the disability community, but was failing to actually support its own colleagues who had this identity. I knew at that point that I wanted to give a voice to genetic counselors with disabilities and chronic illnesses through my capstone project in some way, but it took the better part of my first year and a number of conversations with different community members to really land on my final research question and design the study. There was really no literature out there about the experiences of GCs with disabilities at that time, so there were a million directions that I could have gone with it, but I decided to focus in on experiences in graduate school because this is the entry point into the field and therefore could be a major barrier for inclusion of these individuals in the genetic counseling profession.
Interesting. Yeah, that is definitely an important time in training and a complex time for students. It can be a vulnerable time. And I know the article mentions the complexity of disclosure decisions. I'm curious, could you elaborate on the experiences of the participants that they mentioned in terms of navigating when, how, and to whom to disclose their disability or chronic illness during their training?
Yes. Firstly, I want to acknowledge that not every genetic counseling student with a disability or chronic illness actually gets to choose if, when, and to whom they're disclosing their condition, just depending on how visible their condition may be. But for those who are making those decisions around disclosure, it can be a really complicated and really personal process for students. Disclosure is oftentimes necessary and important to ensure that students are getting the support that they need, whether that be emotional and social support or access to appropriate accommodations that they need for their coursework or for clinical rotations. But this desire to get this support frequently has to be weighed against a fear of discrimination, stigma from other program members. Also, just being aware of the fact that these conversations can be really emotionally draining for students to have with program members. The nature of a relationship is obviously going to be a really important factor in these decisions as well, because some relationships are going to feel like a much safer space to share information about yourself. And some relationships, it may be more or less relevant to talk about someone's disability or chronic illness, for example.
Part of the beginning experiences that led you to this study involved some negative experiences you heard, things that left a pit in your stomach. I'm curious, in this study, can you share some examples of some of the more negative or disappointing experiences that were encountered by the study participants?
Unfortunately, there were quite a few. I'll highlight some of the ones that came up most frequently and were most impactful for a lot of my participants. The first one I would say is coursework and class discussions that treated disability as a patient-only problem without acknowledging that individuals who are in the classroom may actually identify with some of the diagnoses or experiences that are being talked about in class. Also, just the language being used in class discussions. Oftentimes, in speaking about disability, we really center the medical model of disability and focus on the health concerns associated with the diagnosis without a lot of attention to the lived experiences, the psychosocial factors, societal barriers that are important to individuals with those diagnoses as well. Another one would be experiences in clinical rotations where supervisors or other medical providers that students interacted with were making assumptions about patients with disabilities or just generally lacked empathy for the lived experiences of those patients. This occurred both in interactions between supervisors and patients that the students were present for, but also behind closed doors when prepping for sessions or debriefing sessions with students. A lack of flexibility in the curriculum and pressure to really push yourself beyond what feels healthy would be another big one. I would say there are two major contributing factors in this that my participants frequently spoke to. One being that there tends to be a culture within genetic counseling programs where there's a lot of pressure to overachieve and take advantage of all the opportunities that are presented to you, even if that means sacrificing your own needs and your own well-being. This can be harmful to all genetic counseling students, regardless of if they have a disability or chronic illness, but was really impactful for my participants who oftentimes had to spend a lot of additional time and energy navigating various challenges that their classmates didn't necessarily have to be dealing with on top of their schoolwork and clinical rotation work. The other piece being that programs tended to have a focus on equality and what was expected of each student when really they ought to be looking through a lens of equity. And that's a really important distinction that was mentioned by a lot of my participants. For example, not being willing to make adjustments in due dates for a student who's out for a period of time due to medical appointments or something like that. And then the last thing that came up really frequently was difficulties in accessing necessary accommodations or negative attitudes from program members around accommodation use. It can be a really long and draining and complicated process for a lot of students to gain access to the tools that they need in order to have the same opportunities for success as their peers. And unfortunately, after going through that whole process, many did not feel satisfied with what was provided or felt like they were shamed by other program members for utilizing what was provided to them.
Lots of challenges that unfortunately I can see ring true for a lot of folks with disability and chronic illness in our field. That said, not all of the experiences shared or elucidated in your study were negative. On the other hand, I'm curious if you could share examples from the study in which interpersonal relationships with classmates, mentors, or other individuals provided positive support and understanding regarding a disability or a chronic illness.
It made a huge difference when participants had relationships during graduate school that felt safe, people that they could really turn to for support. A lot of students shared that they actually factored this in when choosing a program and elected to stay close to home so that they weren't leaving behind their support system of friends and family that they had had prior to graduate school. And then for program members that they were building new relationships with during graduate school, the most helpful things were really just showing understanding, a lack of judgment, a willingness to listen to lived experiences and needs and take them at face value without making a student justify or explain themselves over and over again. It was through these types of relationships that participants felt most safe to advocate for the things that they needed and also to turn to when they did have negative experiences that had caused harm during their time in the program. And there was a special kind of support that was mentioned from peers who actually had a disability or chronic illness themselves and had similar experiences. So those who had classmates who were also a part of the disability or chronic illness community and were open about that during their time in grad school made grad school feel a lot less isolating. Some also turned to support groups outside of their immediate program, either online or in-person communities. The GC disability group was mentioned really frequently. That's actually where I recruited a lot of my participants from for this study. That has been and continues to be a really great resource for a lot of genetic counselors in graduate school and beyond. So I wanted to specifically highlight that one as a resource for anyone who's listening who might benefit from joining that community but may not have heard about it before.
Yes, definitely. For those who'd like to learn more about the GC disability community and connect with others, we will put information in the show notes. We know that lived experiences of people with disabilities and chronic illnesses are extremely valuable to patient care. In what ways did the experiences of the study participants influence their approach to genetic counseling or the genetic counseling profession?
This is such an important question, and it's something that my participants really emphasized throughout the interviews. It was really important to a lot of my participants that my interviews and that my final paper really highlighted the positive in addition to the negative. So on a general level, I would say that my participants often felt like the challenges they had faced had helped them to develop strengths like resiliency and adaptability, which are obviously helpful skills that can be applied to any part of life, but definitely are helpful skills when navigating the really challenging work that we do as genetic counselors. And then thinking more specifically about patient care, my participants spoke to an increased ability to really empathize with their patients and provide really patient-centered care to their patients. They were able to reflect on their own experiences interacting with medical providers and draw upon what had felt good for them and what hadn't felt good for them when they were in the shoes of the patient. They also had a lot of knowledge about how the medical system works, so they could better help patients in navigating things like insurance issues, referrals, et cetera. We all know that these are not always intuitive processes, so it's a huge asset to have some knowledge that's gained through your own trial and error as a patient. And then I wanted to mention as well that those who were open to sharing their experiences and knowledge with their grad school classmates had classmates tell them that their approach to genetic counseling and talking about disability changed for the better as well. So the impact of the inclusion of genetic counselors with these identities in our field is actually even more far-reaching than many may realize.
And thinking further as well, can you share any potential strategies or initiatives that you think could be implemented to continue to better support genetic counseling students with disabilities and chronic illnesses in graduate programs and beyond?
I think there are a number of things that we could change within GC training to make this a more welcoming and inclusive environment for students with disabilities and chronic illnesses. One would be updating our disability curriculum and really trying to move away from that medical model of disability to make sure we're centering the voices and experiences of individuals who have disabilities and chronic illnesses. Another would be making sure we have safe and effective feedback structures for students of all identities to be able to report harmful experiences when they take place during their time in graduate school. It can be really scary to speak up when you don't trust that the information you share will be handled with care, or when you fear that there could be repercussions for sharing your experiences. This would help everyone, including those with other minority identities, not only those with disabilities, to have these kinds of structures in place. And then improved accommodation access is important, but also just general increased flexibility within programs. This could look like a lot of different things, but a couple examples that were brought up really frequently by my participants were remote coursework options and flexible graduation timelines. Again, this helps everyone, provides a better experience for people of all identities because we all learn in different ways. And then again, just really making sure we're shifting away from inequality mindset and adopting an equity mindset, recognizing that GC education is not a one size fits all. So the way we train genetic counselors should reflect that diversity in the field.
Absolutely. And based on your findings, do you think that there are additional suggestions in terms of how we can make the genetic counseling field as a whole strengthen our inclusion efforts?
Yeah, even though my project was focused on GC education, I think a lot of the findings really could be applicable at all points within the profession for genetic counseling students, faculty at genetic counseling programs, and genetic counselors that are out in the field. One thing would be just to be more thoughtful about the language that we're using. The empathy and care that we strive to show to our patients should translate into all of our interactions, including our interactions with our colleagues. You never know the full story of the person in front of you and want to make sure that you aren't making assumptions and are practicing empathy. Increased visibility of genetic counselors with disabilities and chronic illnesses in leadership positions to help prospective genetic counselors of all abilities to see themselves in this field and know that they can succeed in this field. It's so important to be able to see yourself represented so you feel like you belong in the field. And I heard from my participants again and again about how important it was to be able to build relationships with other genetic counselors who had those shared experiences to make them feel less alone. The last thing would be listening to and empowering all of our colleagues, celebrating everyone for the unique strengths that they bring to this profession. I know I sound like a broken record in saying this, but this is a takeaway that applies to more than just genetic counselors with disabilities. I think that one of the biggest takeaways for me with this project is that what I learned from the disability community in terms of recommendations for this field are actually applicable on such a broad scale in terms of making the field a more inclusive and welcoming place for individuals of all identities and backgrounds.
Great. We really appreciate you sharing the findings from your study and elevating these voices through your research. Anything else that you would like to share about your project, especially for students doing research, since I know you mentioned this was part of your capstone project?
For any genetic counseling students who are considering qualitative research, I would want to say don't shy away from qualitative studies. I know it can feel really daunting. It seems like it's a lot of work to fit into a short span of time, but I can't emphasize enough how rewarding it is to really get to engage with your research participants and then to be able to immerse yourself in the data, highlight the voices of a community in a way that you just aren't able to do through a survey.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Rachel.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to share my research with your listeners.
Hi, I'm Janine J9 Austin. I'm the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Genetic Counseling, which is proudly producing DNA Dialogues. For more information about this episode, visit dnadialogues.podbean.com, where you can also stream all episodes of the show. This same link is also in the show notes for easy access. Any questions, episode ideas, guest pitches, or comments can be sent in to dnadialoguespodcast@gmail.com. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever it is that you listen. This helps us climb the charts and allow other people like you to discover the show. The DNA Dialogues team includes Naomi Wagner, Khalida Liaquat, Kate Wilson, DNA Today's Kira Deneen, and myself, Janine J9 Austin. Thanks for listening to DNA Dialogues. Join us next time to explore the latest genetic counseling research.